Welcome to FO Podcasts. I am Anton Schauble, Assistant Editor-in-Chief of Staff to Fair Observer's Editor-in-Chief. With me is Peter Isaacson, our Chief Strategy Officer and a prolific FO author. Peter is a native son of California, but he now lives a charmed life near Cognac, France. Good afternoon, Peter.
Good afternoon, Anton. Great to be here.
Life on the European continent these days is perhaps a little less charming than it has been. It seems the drums of war are starting to beat. French President Emmanuel Macron has taken an unusually bellicose position on the Russia-Ukraine war. On February 26th, Macron hinted at the possibility of NATO troops entering Ukraine by stating that, quote, nothing should be ruled out. Last Thursday evening, March 14th, he had the opportunity to explain his position at length in a 40-minute televised address. Macron has gone from the would-be peacemaker who flew to Russia to negotiate personally with Putin to a firebrand denouncing the, quote, evil Putin, who is supposedly beyond reason. Russian control of Ukraine, he says, is an existential threat to Europe and to France in particular. Macron tells us that Strasbourg, the easternmost city in France, is a mere 1,500 kilometers away from Lviv, Ukraine's westernmost city. Now, I doubt that Russian troops will be knocking at the gates of Strasbourg anytime soon. Could you tell us just what Macron means by an existential threat?
Well, I think your doubts are justified. I don't think there is any Frenchman that has any sense of reasoning that actually fears Russian troops showing up at the gates of Strasbourg or any other French city. Existential is a great term to use. I mean, it's what politicians like to use in situations of high drama and especially war. If you've followed the debate at all, that's been going on for years about Ukraine, one of the principal explanations of why there is a war in Ukraine, why Russia invaded Ukraine, is that, and this is John Mearsheimer, who's insisted on this over and over again, is that Russia feels an existential threat from NATO, if that is on the condition that NATO is parked on its borders inside Ukraine. So the idea of existential has become now a standard trope of the rhetoric of propaganda.
I'll tell you,
yeah.
I thought the whole point of being a nuclear power was that you don't have existential threats.
Well, true enough, but I mean, there's nuclear power at the time of the Cold War, which was, you know, the mad standoff, mutually assured destruction. I don't think anyone in France would seriously consider that even though France does have nuclear weapons, they could set themselves up as rivals to Russia, because if Russia were to attack France with nuclear arms, there would be nothing left of France, whereas France might do a little bit of damage in Russia before it totally disappears. It's just not a serious thought at all to imagine that France could be, that Macron could be reasoning in those terms.
Of course, in any real world scenario, the United States would doubtlessly be involved by that point.
Well, yeah, absolutely. The U.S. is the elephant in the room, which really struck me when I watched Macron's interview last week, because he went on for 40 minutes talking to some extent about Europe and confusing Europe's security with France's security. But neither he nor the journalist, I don't think, ever mentioned the U.S., as if the U.S. had nothing to do with an escalated confrontation in Ukraine or anywhere else, for that matter. So it's really a bit of kabuki theater that we're watching, everything that's going on. And it's not Macron alone. I've been looking at everyone else who's been weighing in, because it's been a big debate in the last week or so, ever since Macron first came out with the idea of sending troops to Ukraine. But it was followed up by a session in Parliament this week where they debated the so-called treaty, or the agreement that Macron had established, unconstitutionally, by the way, with Zelensky, because that is normally an initiative of Parliament to agree to any kind of foreign policy commitment to another country. But Macron went off on his own, signed the agreement with with Zelensky, came back and then put it in the hands of Parliament to say, accept it or don't. And they couldn't not accept it anyway because it was already signed. So this is I call this hyper-reality. It's all about how you present things and how you make people believe in some kind of imaginary structure of confrontation, of conflict, of rivalry, of adversity, and I'll mention that for a reason, that actually doesn't exist. But if we all believe it exists, we can carry on with the kinds of policies that politicians like Macron are putting forward. And I mention adversity because in the conversation with the journalist, when he was challenged about the fact that he seemed to be referring to Russia as an enemy that had to be confronted in on a battlefield, and then he wanted to walk that back by saying, oh, "Well, no, Russia isn't an enemy; it's an adversary." So you're getting some really interesting language coming out. And as the author of Fair Observer's Devil's Dictionary, to a certain extent, I enjoy this because it does make for interesting copy at times. But it is incredibly irresponsible piece of work by a politician who's supposedly responsible for his entire nation.
It seems that way, let alone what Macron privately thinks. It's not really entirely obvious how he even wants to be perceived as thinking right now. I'm not sure what the narrative is.
Well, it's certainly not obvious because another way he had of walking back some of his more outrageous assertions, one of the ways is to say, oh, this is strategic ambiguity. Now, strategic ambiguity, of course, is taken to mean in military terms that you don't let your enemy, or you give them the impression that you're going to do something else, and then you do the contrary, or something that he hadn't suspected. Now, if you say that in the context of something like NATO, where you have 32 nations supposedly all tied together with a common interest that requires pretty good coordination in times of war, you're running a big risk of creating confusion because not only does your adversary not understand what your ambiguity is, but obviously your friends don't either, your allies.
And there's enough ambiguity built into the system already.
Yes. You know, when Shakespeare dealt with that in Macbeth, he didn't call it ambiguity, he called it equivocation. And that actually was a word that was bandied about a lot at that time in the trial of the people held responsible for the attack on Parliament by Guy Fawkes. I don't know how the Elizabethans may have pronounced his name.
let's move on.
Yeah.
So Russia is an enemy or adversary of France. How is France preparing to meet this adversary, according to Macron? He said that he's converting the country to a war economy. But does France even have the capacity for such a
thing? No, but they do have. But the French have the capacity to take that as a joke. Not that it was intended as a joke, but they react to it as if it was a joke, because quite obviously France does not have that capacity. And there was one military person quoted by Marianne who said, in front of, if we were to have a standoff or a competition or any kind of showdown with Russia, France would be, and I'm not sure, be the equivalent of majorette cheerleaders. But to go back to the question of war economy, though, I think that's an interesting question.
Sure.
It's interesting because a bit like existential, it's obviously overblown. If we are talking about a real war economy, we're talking about the kind of thing that the U.S. did in the Second World War, and which the U.S. had the leisure to do because the Europeans couldn't do much with their industry as they were totally embattled. But a country that decided it's going into war and has industrial capacity has to dedicate 100% of that capacity to the war effort, which also includes keeping your own citizens healthy and alive and keeping your life going on. But it also meant that any excess industrial capacity, anything that wasn't required for survival at home, would be dedicated to producing for a war economy. Now, there is no population in today's world, apart from maybe Ukraine itself, where the people themselves are ready even to envisage what it might amount to putting into effect a war economy, where everything they had to do had to be justified by its contribution to the war. So talking about that in Europe today is really ludicrous. But Macron isn't afraid of being ludicrous. And the French actually do laugh at it, but they still tolerate it, which always surprises me. I'd like them to laugh a bit harder.
So by a war economy, we would imagine a whole of society approach to war, which is just not even close to what we're seeing or would imagine seeing in France today.
Well, as you pointed out, France doesn't have the capacity to start with. And even if you took the capacity it does have, and it's not insignificant, nobody could realistically think that it would have enough of an effect to justify the kind of sacrifice that the government would be asking people to do. Now, one thing that's interesting in this piece of theater, really, is that Macron had already tested the idea, not of a war economy, but of a society dedicated to fighting a war. And that was with COVID in 2020, when he said on television, very seriously and solemnly and effectively, really, at the time, this is a war and we have to combat it. And actually speaking to people, even in the street, after that intervention, I discovered that his approach was appreciated, that people thought this was a good idea because they were so confused and they thought it was he was expressing leadership. Because the situation with COVID was so confused, and there was no enemy. I mean, there was no human enemy. There was nobody you could mobilize against. So it made some sense to say, okay, we as humanity and as a specific society need to summon up all our effort to combat this, and that it requires sacrifice. But asking for sacrifice today for Ukraine is something that very few French people they'll do out of sympathy, and they do sympathize with the Ukrainian people. They will give it some support. But the idea of mobilizing and transforming their lives in order to accomplish a purpose which they don't perceive as being pertinent to their survival, and therefore it's not existential, except for Macron, nobody would go along with that today. I mean, no. When I say nobody, really, 99% of the population just could not follow. So it sounds like rhetoric that worked, and then people take it to be rhetoric. And we've got to the point where the way the media work today, people are used to rhetoric today. What they aren't used to is assuming that the rhetoric actually corresponds to any real meaning.
Right. And you would expect this conversation that Macron is trying to have to happen behind closed doors before he went on television to talk about it. And I wouldn't think that his sentiments are shared in Berlin or in Rome. How have the other European partners been reacting to Macron's comments?
Well, they've reacted very negatively. They don't want to be seen as being involved in or having to assent to a position of NATO involvement in something which only makes sense if NATO is not involved, because it was all it all boils down to, and Stoltenberg himself admitted this, that it's all about NATO enlargement. That's why there's a problem in Ukraine. So if there's a problem of enlargement, saying that you're going to enlarge it by engaging in combat means that NATO has already enlarged and that Russia is justified. So it's a totally absurd position to take. Now, you mentioned that you would expect that Macron would deal with this behind closed doors before he actually came up and said anything publicly. But what you have to bear in mind is, first of all, that he does not really do a lot of coordination behind doors with his allies, and it's not easy to do that. And Europe is just simply not as unified as some people would like to think, that now that there is a mission, or has been for the last 2 years, in Ukraine, all the European countries, especially those who've newly adhered to NATO, are totally on board with everything it decides. There is no unanimity, and it's quite a lot of bickering behind doors that nobody hears about. But the other consideration concerning what decisions are made behind doors is that Macron, when he talks to people behind doors, he's talking to them about his status as a politician in France, as a political leader, as the president of the country, as the symbol of the nation's unity, but also as the leader of a political movement. And there are the issue of concern today is less Ukraine, except symbolically, than the European elections, the parliamentary elections that will take place in June. And the reason they're a problem isn't for Macron and something to worry about seriously, is not so much that the results of the election in terms of the composition of the European Parliament are important. Everyone knows that the European Parliament doesn't play any major legislative role that affects people's lives. No, the problem for Macron is that the polls show currently that the right-wing party, the Rassemblement National, Marine Le Pen's party, is polling at 31%. And Macron's party is at 18%. So he has to find a way of taking a position that seems significant and seems to put pressure on people to go with him. And a lot of people in his own party think this is a bad choice, that he shouldn't be focusing on the threat of the Rassemblement National. He should be diversifying his themes and trying to pick up votes from other sectors of the different parties that are vying for seats in parliament. But so it's a confusing situation, but it's one in which Ukraine simply becomes the symbolic theme that people can refer to as being an issue on which Macron can show his strength and courage and resolution.
So it seems like it's more the symbolic value that has utility for Macron than any kind of realistic attempt to get his NATO allies to be involved in Ukraine. There's not a hard plan of any kind, or
no, exactly. The journalists tried to get him pin him down on that. Obviously, there's a question of sending troops, and there are various ways that he's used or his team have used to walk that back. But there's also engagement in, well, the war economy, as you mentioned, the idea of converting to a war economy. But the other suggestions were that French engineers and miners and counselors, advisors and so on, would be doing useful things in Ukraine rather than shooting at Russians. But of course, that a lot of people have ridiculed that. I mean, here in France, have ridiculed it on the grounds that when you talk about troops on the ground, groups are not technicians. They're not D minors. They're people that are armed to kill and part of a force that's organized to combat another. So you wouldn't use that vocabulary of sending troops. You would just as, yeah, you know, even in the years, the Vietnam years, or the even in Kennedy's time, the Americans would send advisors to Vietnam, but not troops.
It seems to be a pattern that plays out a lot on televised politics lately. Or I'm a little too young to tell you if televised politics weren't like this in decades past.
Well, I'm old enough to tell you that it was different.
Abolish the police doesn't really mean abolish the police after a couple of weeks.
Well, it was, I think that controversy was defund the police, but yeah. No, but you're absolutely right.
Right. Defund the police turned into moving some of the funds away from police towards community initiatives and ended up fizzling into nothing as the people who proposed it walked it back. Is that what we're going to see?
Well, no, I don't think you have that kind of debate or that kind of degradation of language. I mean, it is a degradation of language. It's an abuse of language. It's an abuse of language.
American levels of nonsense.
Sorry?
France hasn't quite reached American levels of nonsense.
Well, it has its own style of nonsense. I mean, every culture does. But American nonsense has become quite extraordinary with the whole woke movement. France is aware of that and trying to resist it. But nevertheless, I mean, political language will always be extreme. It will always go beyond the bounds of rational meaning. I think that's inevitable. I mean, you're a student of Greek philosophy, and you know that the Greek orators, and of course, rhetoric was taken seriously as a kind of science for the Greeks, and in fact, for most of Europeans for thousands of years. One of my complaints is that we've lost our sense of what rhetoric is, because when you know what rhetoric is, you can understand how it's being used, and you can then use it to construct meaning at different level. But we've moved away from that. And I complain that our education system, because they don't recognize rhetoric as being one of the fundamentals of one of the fundamental skills that are required in a civilized society, that they just let themselves be overrun by the abuse of language. And you know, it's advertising, it's propaganda, it's the culture created by people like Edward Bernays, Freud's nephew. And once you accept as a civilization that language is something that's purely instrumental, you know, it's used for selling things, it's used for imposing ideas, rather than engaging in dialogue, where if you know how rhetoric works, if you study it, if you're aware of it, you can, it's not that you can manipulate it against the other person, it's that you can frame things in ways that both sides or all sides can take into account and relativize. And you're not stuck with having to decide this is exactly what the truth is. The truth is always nuanced. But truth is not about facts. It's also about intentions. And that's where rhetoric plays all kinds of tricks. And so if we don't know what the rhetoric is, if we don't know what rhetoric function is in public discourse, and public discourse is what politicians do, it's what journalists do, what the media does, if you don't know what that's all about and how it works, you can easily become, a whole society can become victim of groupthink that allows certain ideas just to exist, even though they no longer correspond to observable reality.
So that's where we've gotten. We've gotten, you're saying, to a point where rhetoric has become unmoored from logic. We're talking about talking more than talking about reality. And maybe, perhaps nothing epitomizes that more than, as you mentioned earlier, Macron's failure to mention the United States in 40 minutes of remarks. He's painting a picture more than usefully describing the situation. And the elephant in the room, which must have been on Macron's mind while he was making these kinds of choices, is that the European parliamentary elections are not the only elections on the horizon. In November, we'll be seeing a U.S. presidential election, and if polls are to be believed, Donald Trump has a good chance of coming back. How much does that prospect play into the equation for Macron?
Oh, it's enormous. It's enormous for everyone in Europe, every European politician, journalist as well. There's something totally irrational, not necessarily about Trump himself, but about the image people have of who Trump is and how he'll behave. And of course, the one thing that's obvious and true is that he's unpredictable. And you have a lot of people saying, oh, well, he did this in his first term, so we're going to see more of the same. And then other two saying, well, no, now he knows what happened in the first term, so he's going to do the complete opposite. On foreign policy, obviously, it's just totally up in the air. And the only thing that's being seriously debated, not by Europeans, but people like some of the more serious intellectual commentators, including John Mearsheimer, is that Trump this all depends on how he presents himself as well, because we don't know what he's going to do in the campaign, but he may be perceived as more amenable to a peace policy because he can claim that in his first term, he didn't start any wars, and that therefore the trend will be towards diplomacy. But then you look at Trump and you say, is this someone who even has a notion of what diplomacy is? And the sad thing about the world we live in today, and I can say this particularly about the French, where historically we have a great tradition of diplomacy, is that diplomacy has disappeared as a means of addressing problems in today's politics. It hasn't disappeared in the intellectual debates in France, because you have people like, a book that really impressed me recently was Histoire Diplomatique by Gérard Araud, a former diplomat, who makes the case, and he describes through historical examples how diplomacy worked and how rhetoric, but also the game of the power game work, and how it can actually produce effective but not totally satisfying solutions. But the most effective solutions in diplomacy are ones that never satisfy all parties and probably fail to satisfy all parties. And then you have people like, and I'll mention this because I've been following fairly closely the various interventions Dominique de Villepin has made recently. Now, here's someone who's associated with the Gaullist tradition. He was prime minister under Chirac. He was France's representative of the United Nations in 2003, who made a stirring speech announcing his dissent from the Bush policy and France's refusal to accompany the U.S. in its invasion of Iraq. And he's someone who's absolutely a skilled diplomat. He's not part of any current political party, but he is a person a prominent personality, a very recognizable personality, both in the media and historically. And he's saying things that are totally contrary to all the policies we're seeing, or that any of the parties, for that matter, are putting forward. So you do have this background of diplomatic thinking in French culture, which I maintain may emerge. It may reemerge as the chaos continues to unfold and as things get worse. I have some hope that this tradition, I can also cite Henri Guénaud, who was a close collaborator of Sarkozy. So you have people on the left as well, and they're here. The people I'm talking about are right or center right. There are people on the left, obviously, who criticize, who tend to be to take a position that's less bellicose, less warmongering than people like Macron, or for that matter, and many of the others who absolutely believe that you have to fight to defend principles. You have to talk to defend principles and then fight when there's no other solution. But there is in the background in French society, in French culture, the idea that diplomacy is something we're really good at as a culture, and even the French language is good at it. So why not push forward one's role? And this is where Macron seems to be at odds with his own culture. Instead of pushing forward the idea that we can stand up and solve the problem through force without even explaining what that force is and how it's going to be used, you say we can stand up and find the ways of creating the dialogue that's required to get diplomacy working and to find solutions which we cannot imagine today, because they'll be the result of the give and take that takes place in a diplomatic situation.
We'd have to begin imagining the solutions today, or we'd never be able to evaluate whether there is need for fighting.
Exactly. So which is why you the first thing you say is, let's do that, but let's envisage fighting if we can't get anywhere with that. But here you've got Macron saying, actually, what he's saying is that he knows, like everyone, that the situation for Ukraine has become pretty desperate. So he's saying, well, this is because it's desperate and because it may get more desperate, we need to act now and stop thinking and stop talking. But then he doesn't have a plan of action either. So that's where you should be sitting back and saying, well, now we really need to be creative about the kind of diplomacy we can do and how we can define what our position of force might be, rather than just saying, let's let the force play out, or try to add a bit of force materially and artificially, and then see what kind of catastrophe that leads to. That's just a totally defeatist position, really. But because the irony of the situation is that because NATO does not have a leader. Stoltenberg is not a decision maker. There's no one you can go to and say, okay, now what do we do? How do we organize? It is a debate going on, but it's a chaotic debate, which is the opposite of a diplomatic debate. A diplomatic debate is where you assess what the current positions are, what kind of force they represent, and what kind of impact they can be interpreted as having, and then you confront them and see where they take you. But what's really catastrophic about the NATO situation is that there are a lot of disparate positions which are not being articulated publicly. And then when someone like Macron comes out and seems to take a public position that appears or wishes to present itself as the common position, people shoot it down. And then it just gives an impression of total disunity.
Is there room for a charitable interpretation where we could say that Macron has at least gotten the ball rolling, started a conversation that wasn't happening previously?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's a kind of provocation that could be justified on those grounds, that it needed the shaking up of confronting the various ideas that are floating around and putting forward an extreme one and saying, how do we reevaluate all the other positions and how do we find one that is actually operative? The other charitable remark I would make toward Macron is that, and this is more subtle, more nuanced, and I'm not sure if it's true, is that we know that Macron has always been in favor of the old Gaullist position, that Europe needed to have its own autonomy, that it needed to have its identity as well. And that identity came at the cost of not only economic organization, but military and security organization. So that there had to be something like a European Defense Force, which was not NATO, but not necessarily incompatible with NATO, but something that represented Europe itself. And Macron made, in his first term, made several strong forays in that direction. And he made it clear that he was impatient. And he even said at one point that he thought NATO was brain dead, which was a bit extreme as well. But so that demonstrates what you're saying, that he has a talent for saying things that are provoking at times just in order to get the debate moving. But he has always been, whether you could say committed to, at least curious about or interested in European defense system. And what he's doing now is a kind of shake-up of the ideas and commitments of the different NATO nations that may lead inevitably to a conclusion that he's not putting forward, but which is the one he really wants, which is, hey, we've got to get together without the U.S., without the guidance of the U.S., and build some. Now everyone's involved in NATO, which we've got Finland and Sweden, Turkey's still there, and so on. Now is the time when we can define our own security system. But he has to let the chaos develop before that actually takes place. Now, is that a strategy? Is that what he's doing? Will it work? Nobody knows. There's no way of telling what he's really thinking, and there's no way of predicting where that could lead, because it depends on how all these different parties are going to react.
Might end up being one of those initiatives where we decide what our intentions were after we see how they work out.
Well, that's how history works. You're right.
So earlier you were contrasting Macron with Gaullist positions. Now you've placed him within the Gaullist tradition. So this is something, as an American who's not deeply familiar with French politics, how alive is Gaullism today? What shape is it taking? And to what extent can we describe Macron as more than a piecemeal Gaullist?
Well, yeah, I think you've hit it. You've found the right description. He's a piecemeal Gaullist, as most French politicians are. They have to be. De Gaulle had a major impact. Well, he was, of course, the founder of the Fifth Republic. We're still living within the Fifth Republic. So he's the father of the nation. He's the George Washington of France. So you have to pay some respect to him. And it's just impossible to conclude anything other than that the fact that de Gaulle was an incredibly influential figure as a politician, more as a politician than as a general. But there is a true, there are true Gaullists, I would say. I mean, the ones that, which I mentioned earlier, for example, Dominique de Villepin and Henri Guénaud, who claim, who say that that they are hearkening back to the Gaullist principles. What Americans need to understand is that de Gaulle was significant for a number of things he did. The most dramatic of which were leaving NATO. Well, not leaving NATO itself. He didn't leave NATO, but he left the command structure of NATO. But France was still associated with NATO. And curiously, it was Sarkozy, who in France was called when he was president, Sarkozy l'Américain, Sarkozy the American, because he was more likely to align with the American vision of the world. Whereas de Gaulle was known at the time, and he did several significant things that made that clear, such as leaving the command structure of NATO. But another that he did, which was extremely significant, is that he challenged the Bretton Woods system as it had evolved 20 years after, where you had the dollar that was convertible with gold. And de Gaulle challenged that system, which nobody had thought of doing, by saying, okay, all the reserves we're building up of dollars, because at the time the U.S. was allowing everyone, they were spending money everywhere, especially on wars, and allowing others to export to the American consumer society. So reserves were building up everywhere, including in France. And instead of holding on to those reserves, which were essential for doing all kinds of things everywhere in the world, so if you were buying oil from the Middle East, you bought them, you used the dollars you had for that oil. But countries all across the globe were accumulating dollars. And de Gaulle said, oh, well, I don't believe in the stability of the dollar. I'm going to use it to buy the equivalent in gold and build my gold reserves. Well, this caused a panic. And it finally led to Nixon's initiative in 1971. This was in 65, I think, or 66, that de Gaulle announced that he would start converting dollars to gold. And that led to Nixon taking the dollar off the gold exchange standard. And that led to the creation of the petrodollar, which was a kind of substitute. But so de Gaulle had an enormous influence on history by taking the action he did with NATO, contesting the dollar, redefining the global, well, making an attempt to redefine the definition people had in their minds of how the global economy worked. So it's that de Gaulle who dared to stand up to the U.S. on the military, on the economy, that represents an attitude which has been lost, because every French president since then has found ways of conforming to or adapting to a system defined by the U.S. financially and militarily. And that's what we're seeing now, is the incapacity of any European company, including France, to show any independence from policies defined through NATO.
Macron is calling for, or maybe not calling for is the right word. Macron is attempting to move towards something like a greater European institutional independence, but we haven't yet achieved European intellectual independence in foreign policy.
Yes, but you know what he may be calculating is when you look at how the world is evolving, most people now say that it is no longer the unipolar world that existed after 1991, that we're in a multipolar world, but a transitioning multipolar world. It's significant that last year, Macron tried to invite himself to the BRICS conference in South Africa. And he was refused because it made no sense that BRICS was about emerging economies and France is a well-established developed economy with a seat in the UN Security Council. So that made no sense at all for him even to be an observer at BRICS. But the fact that he requested a visiting right to a BRICS conference, which people interpreted as being the prelude to demanding membership at some time in the future, shows that he's aware that the whole power structure, the hegemonic power structure of the world, is shifting, and that maybe there's a different place for France, and maybe France should be aligned with the non-aligned country, but in a Gaullist way, that is, moving away from the strict alignment that it has to NATO and to a rules-based order and to everything else, but not breaking that relationship to establish one with other countries. But we're seeing something of the same logic playing out, and it concerns Macron's positions today in Sahel, where the debate going on with the countries that were former French colonies and that in the last couple of years have rejected French, even the relationship they had, post-colonial relationship with France. So we had the coup in Niger very recently. So there are three countries, Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger, who've broken away from that French colonial tradition. And what they're saying is, and now recently, and just in the last week, Niger has said they want the Americans, who have a base in Niger, they want the Americans to leave. But they're not saying, we want you to leave because we're tired of you and we don't want Americans to help. They're saying, we're asking you to leave simply because you're impertinent. You're telling us that if we continue, we have to break the relationship we're building with Russia. So the Americans are saying, we can't be here if you're aligned with Russia. And Niger is saying, well, why can't we have both? Because this is all about fighting terrorism, not about adjudicating Ukraine. So we're starting to see situations like this in the world. And we've seen it traditionally with India. And again, with India, it's been very much a matter of debate about India's position with Russia or its friendship with Russia, whereas it's pretty strongly aligned on many other issues with the West.
It seems Africa is reshuffling, and it's not obvious that France has a strategy there.
Well, France does have a strategy. It's just not one that's working. I mean, they've always had a strategy.
Yeah, I mean, it's not obvious that they have an updated strategy. Of course, Russia is moving in to fill a lot of the vacuum that's being left behind by departing French presence in the Sahel, or at least Russian-based private military contractors like the Wagner Group. This must be causing a good amount of anxiety in Paris. How does that play into the Franco-Russian relationship?
Oh, well, you're absolutely right to suggest that a factor that has motivated Macron to be very anti-Russian and to turn up the heat on combating Russia in Ukraine. There can't be any direct relationship between what actually happened there, but it is a question to some extent of ego, of vanity, and humiliation. Yeah, I'm pretty certain that there is something going on there. You could say strategically what France wants to do now is weaken Russia, the way that Lloyd Austin said was the aim of the U.S. in Ukraine. So if Russia is weakened, France will have freer hand in places like former colonies in Africa.
And that's not what you consider a winning strategy.
Well, no, I don't think it's a bad strategy. I don't think it has any legs in it. It won't take the French anywhere. But it's like a chess game. There are things you have to do just to maintain a position, right. And even though you're not accomplishing anything, but you've got to have your pawns in a certain place that aren't being threatened. I don't know how to judge what's going to happen in Africa, but obviously, what is going on everywhere is that all these conflicts. Well, we've got two major conflicts, so in Ukraine, in the Middle East, which everyone's involved in. Both of them are potential world wars, and they play out. The effects play out everywhere. The effects obviously were very evident as soon as the Ukraine conflict began, in terms of the impact on economies in the global south, which had a strong effect on determining the positions people took, which a lot of the Western countries and the U.S. in particular found disappointing, because they were expecting that given the degree of dependence that a lot of countries have on institutions that are controlled by the U.S., they would have to somehow align fairly, fairly positively with positions the U.S. took. And then they were extremely surprised and disappointed when that didn't happen. And the particular case of India is an obvious one. But so there are all these things going on at the same time, and they're all linked in strange ways, some of them purely historical. If France had not had colonies in the Sahel, that question of worrying about how the Russians are behaving in Africa wouldn't even come up. So I have no conclusive remark to make on what all that means.
Well, we'll end on that note.
Okay, yeah.
Predictions, we have none. Aspirations, we do. There may be light at the end of the tunnel for a more circumspect and diplomatic era.
Yeah, I'm hoping that the kind of crisis, which you could call a diplomatic crisis, I mean, it's the zero degree of diplomacy we have today, both in Ukraine and in the Middle East, that when a crisis like that becomes so aggravated, in the end, people have to sit down and say, never again, you know, just like a Holocaust. And that doesn't mean that there won't be another one after that. But it does mean that people have to sit down and work out things in a different way, at least temporarily. And I think there is a future for diplomacy. Now, will it be artificial intelligence that does our diplomacy in the future? I don't know.
That would be thrilling. But I guess we'll have to wait and see.
Yeah, we do. We're just honest citizens who... spectators who watch all these things taking place. But what's interesting is that the great actors who seem to be in charge are also just spectators.
I'll tell you what, I think we might let the just spectators line be the last line in the podcast.
Okay.